In 1834, a coroner attended to a lodging house in London to collect a dead body. He arrived to find the room packed with beds to house all of the lodgers, and headed to the bed that held the corpse. The coroner was shocked to see the man's face, already black with putrefaction. He turned to the landlady, Mary Wood, and told her that the man was already in an advanced state of decomposition and must have died several days ago. The coroner looked around him and asked her how many lodgers she had sharing the room's 7 beds, and she replied, 17. 17 lodgers, 2 to 3 of them per bed. She assured the coroner that the dead man hadn't shared his bed with anyone, and went on to explain that she had come up to the room the past several days, and she just thought he was sleeping. Apparently, it wasn't out of the ordinary for lodgers of this sort to go to bed in a stupor and just not get up for days. Besides, she told the coroner, my lodgers comes and goes and minds their own business. They goes in and out without seeming to care for each other. Along with the news that the lodger was identified as 36-year-old James Parkinson, purveyor of cat meat, the newspaper printed the astonishing news that nearly 20 people shared a room with a corpse for 3 days before it was finally discovered. Such was the state of lodging houses, they printed. The stench, the filth they must live with on a daily basis, must have been so horrid as to be indistinguishable from a rotting corpse. I'm Elise, and this is Old Blood. As I was researching this case, it struck me that boarding houses don't really exist anymore. I mean, we have hotels, of course, and we have Airbnb, but even that, even the listings that have several rooms for rent, still aren't boarding houses. And I wondered why this was. I mean, surely there are tons of people in need of just a room or two for a while, more than a couple weeks, but don't exactly want to sign a year's lease. And with rent so expensive here in the U.S., especially in states like California, wouldn't there be a pretty high demand for decently priced rooms for people on the move, or people without families? I think it would be perfect for college students or single working folk who don't necessarily have the time or energy to spend preparing meals for themselves. Think of the simplicity of letting a room on a monthly basis. No strings attached, no obligation to stay for a certain period of time, and being able to tack home-cooked meals onto your bill so that you never have to worry about meal planning, shopping, cooking, cleaning. Or for the elderly who don't necessarily need medical care, but want the comfort of having people around to help them out or socialize with. I imagine it would be great for people who want to work from home, too, to be able to earn extra money just for renting out a room and providing meals. I mean, if you are the type of person who is always cooking and cleaning for your family anyway, it's almost like getting free money. So what gives? Why no boarding homes? The other thought that I had was, despite the fact that no one I know has ever stayed in one, we all still generally know what a boarding house is. That's because you used to be able to find them everywhere. 221B Baker Street, home to the fictional Sherlock Holmes and his landlady, Mrs. Hudson. Some pretty famous authors like Edgar Allan Poe lived in boarding homes. And when Jo March from Little Women goes to New York City, hoping to make it as a writer, she also stays in a boarding home that she describes as a big house full of strangers. And it's where she meets her future husband, also a boarder. According to Joseph O'Neill, boarding homes were so popular that in England, 1 out of 8 homes housed some sort of lodger, and in cities like York, it was 1 in 5. Wendy Gamber claims that in America, 1/3 to 1/2 of 19th century city dwellers were either boarders or took them in. She also claims that in Philadelphia, one out of every four houses was a boarding home. That is a tremendous amount of people involved in the boarding business over the years, and it surely had a greater impact on 19th century society than we realize. Because boarding homes naturally attract those on the go, and those who always come and go, they have always had a bad reputation for being magnets for the, let's say, less proper of society. Critics of boarding houses argued that they were houses of sin, full of prostitutes, criminals, drug addicts and alcoholics, and, gasp, foreigners. And then there were concerns over the proprietors and their business practices. Stories like the one I shared at the beginning of this episode about boarders sharing a room with a corpse for 3 days before noticing confirmed what so many had been saying about boarding homes being unsanitary dens of filth and disrepute. But this didn't stop boarding homes from being necessary. The 19th century was the era of urban expansion, where people began flocking to the cities for work. As most of these migrants couldn't afford a home of their own and were leaving their families behind, boarding homes were often their only option. And as the world grew more interconnected and immigrants flocked to different countries, larger cities with their ports and railroad stations required temporary housing for those entering the country. It is no coincidence that transportation hubs like New York City, with high numbers of boarding homes, grew so spectacularly during the 19th century. Ruth Graham wrote in the Boston Globe that boarding houses were a key part of how 19th century cities grew. And so, necessary evil that they were, governments began reforming boarding homes and setting regulations. In 1851, Britain passed the Common Lodging House Act, which detailed the amount of beds these homes should have, required owners to notify authorities in the case of disease outbreak, and required improvements in sanitation. Over time, these laws grew to include mandates that windows be opened for specific periods of the day to let in fresh air, that lodgers could not be housed in cellars, and dictating the number of toilets needed per lodger. Because all women boarding houses were often rumored to be brothels, most homes were co-ed, though these were not always safe for women and still carried the stigma of being improper places for decent young ladies. So the YWCA, the Young Women's Christian Association, opened heavily supervised all-girls homes. Jessica Hester, who wrote A Brief History of Co-Living Spaces, said these were, quote, brick-and-mortar chastity belts cast in the role of protecting women's virtue against the city's vices, end quote. Though boarding homes never completely shed the stigma of being hotbeds of vice and immorality, the establishment of decent boarding homes for respectable people began to change attitudes towards them slightly. One of these respectable boarding homes was on 4 Euston Square in London, operated by Mary Bastendorf and her husband, Severin Bastendorf. Sinclair McKay, whose book provides most of the details for this episode, wrote that being in Euston Square, the Bastendorf's boarding home attracted ladies and gentlemen from the more decent parts of the city. And though neighbors likely frowned at the idea of living next to such a home initially, the Bastendorfs never gave them any reasons to complain about it. 4 Euston Square had 4 floors with which to house the Bastendorfs and their lodgers. The Bastendorfs occupied the top of the house, and boarders stayed on the 1st and 2nd floors. For us Americans, remember that while we start at the 1st floor, the English start at ground floor, making their 1st floor our 2nd floor, and so on. The home was comfortable and shielded from the busy street's noise and dirt with shutters and heavy curtains, and the floors were lined with expensive green carpets. And if all the fabrics made the home a little too dark, the rooms were also lit with gas lamps. The Bastendorf home had several options for lodgers, ranging from single bedrooms to quarters that also included sitting rooms for a higher rate. Some rooms faced Euston Square, and others look out at the backyard. Some rooms they rented furnished, and others were not. The ground floor housed the kitchen stocked with groceries to feed guests, and a drawing room that was at times open to the boarders. Beneath that lie two cellars to store coal. Both Mary and Severin were in their early 30s and had four children. Mary was still grieving the loss of their other three babies, and thus spent as much time as she could with her surviving children, opting to leave the boarding home's daily work to the one female servant they could afford. Mary was English-born, but Severin was born in Luxembourg and was one of many proud German immigrants to London at this time. His furniture business was doing quite well, as he specialized in pieces made of painted bamboo, which was quite fashionable at that time. His workshop, once a studio used by the man who lived there previously, was located at the back of 4 Euston Square. The workshop employed other male craftsmen, including Severin's brothers. On May 9th, 1879, the home was ready for a new tenant, Mr. Brooks. Mary was glad to have him, as he booked the largest and most expensive of the rooms on the first floor with the balcony facing Euston Square. This was a relief for Mary, as business had slowed down a bit. Before he arrived, Mary asked 15-year-old William Stroman to clear out one of the coal cellars for their new tenant to use, as was expected. This cellar was a bit forgotten. Mary herself almost never went down there, and though the servant girl did occasionally, it was often just to throw down trash, like bones from leftover meals. In fact, not long before, the servant went down there and picked up a small piece of bone that was blackened with coal, and simply threw it back down, thinking it a chicken bone or something like that. So when William Stroman went down with a basket and shovel to clean out the cellar, and when, sifting through the trash and coal, found a bone, he might have at first thought it just leftovers from someone's dinner. But then he realized that the bone was actually quite large, and then he saw that the bone was connected to a human foot. Stroman bolted out of the cellar and out to the workshop, where the men were working, and told Albert Savage and his brother Joseph what he found. The three of them went into the cellar, where Joseph grabbed hold of a dirty piece of fabric and pulled on it to see what it was. The fabric began disintegrating, but he kept pulling until he realized that the boy was telling the truth. There was a human corpse in the coal cellar. The Savage brothers unearthed the body from the mounds of coal, finding what was mostly a skeleton with several pieces of fabric and skin still attached. While Stroman ran out to the street to get a policeman who was on duty just outside, Joseph began throwing chlorine of lime powder on the floor to make sure that no smells made their way up into the house. It was an odd move that McKay chalked up to him being in shock, because no one who entered the cellar ever smelled any sort of putrefaction. In any case, Joseph was adamant that he kept the powder far away from the body so as to not spoil anything for the police. At some point, one of the Savage brothers informed Mary about the discovery, who in turn told her husband. And the on-duty policeman entered the cellar to observe the corpse while waiting for his superiors, knowing that this was clearly above his pay grade. When investigators arrived on the scene, they observed what the policeman had: a mostly skeletonized body, still partially clothed, wrapped in oilcloth. The body was positioned face down with one arm slung diagonally across the underside of the body. There were no hands, and the legs were severed at the knees. The skull had only several patches of hair still attached, and though there was no skin on the face or front of the neck, there was still some skin on the back of the neck held in place by a thin clothesline-type rope wrapped twice around the neck. Investigators sent the body to the morgue and began questioning the occupants of 4 Euston Square. Mary and Severin both explained that they couldn't even remember the last time they were down in the coal cellar, and that they couldn't even imagine who the body could be. None of their boarders, past or present, had gone missing, nor had anyone who worked in the house or workshop. The police determined that it was unlikely any of the men from the workshop had access to the cellar to leave a corpse, what with them having to go through the busy house first. Neither did the servant girl have any idea who it could be, and explained that though she went into the cellar occasionally, she never found anything amiss other than the small bone she mistook for trash. And no one in the house ever smelled anything bad coming from the cellar, which was reasonable because all of that coal acted as a deodorant. Investigators began looking into the home's boarders, and even the man who lived there before the Bastendorfs, thinking that the body could possibly outdate the Bastendorfs' 3-year residency there. And yet, none of the leads proved promising. They had no clue whose body was found in the cellar, so they turned to the coroners. At the morgue, Henry Peril Davis concluded that the corpse belonged to a woman between 50 and 70 years old. The clothes found at the scene belonged to a woman, a silk dress and silk jacket, lace shawl, and a bonnet that was in style 2 to 3 years earlier, along with a brooch and ring. The few pieces of ringlets still attached to the scalp also confirmed this theory that the body was female. And yet, Davis could not determine a cause of death. The severed hands and bottom halves of the legs were a product of decomposition, and not from when the victim was alive. Her bones looked normal, and he could not examine the organs as he otherwise would, because most of them had shriveled up. He said that it was possible she was stabbed, and pointed to the skin being gone from the front of the neck but not the back, saying, "If any wound was inflicted in the front of the neck, it would possibly more easily decompose." Now, this was hardly a cause of death, much less a theory, even, but Davis wanted to remind people of the many ways she could have died that would not be evident in what remained of the body. Dr. Pepper, not the drink but the pathologist, also examined the body. He concluded that the woman was likely there in the cellar for 1 to 2 years. The cord embedded in her neck convinced Dr. Pepper that she was probably not strangled. The location of the rope, right beneath her jaw, at a 45-degree angle, told him that the rope was probably used either in suicide or was wrapped around her neck in order to drag the body somewhere. Newspapers all over began printing news of the coal cellar discovery, which is how the parents of Hannah Dobbs heard of the case and sent word to the London police to report that they feared the body belonged to their daughter, who once worked for the Bastendorfs. Their daughter was only in her early 20s, so she didn't exactly fit the profile, but the police looked into it anyway. They discovered that the reason why her family hadn't heard from her in so long was that she was in prison for petty theft. But she was very much alive. Journalists visited Hannah Dobbs' hometown and heard scandalous rumors about her being promiscuous and committing the same sort of petty theft that had landed her in jail. When the police questioned Hannah in prison, she confessed that she did have a compulsive urge to steal. They asked her about her time at Euston Square as a servant, which she described as uneventful. They brought Hannah to view the corpse, and though she couldn't identify the woman, she said that the diamond pattern cloth the body was wrapped in belonged to the Bastendorfs. And then the police received another message, this time from a man named Edward Hacker. He said that his sister was missing, and that although they usually only saw each other several times a year, he had not heard from her in 2 years, which was unusual. He knew she had gone to London, but didn't know where, and Edward recognized that his sister fits the profile of the dead woman. When Edward was allowed to look at the corpse, he took a look at the clothing and the now fading but once dyed red ringlets, and identified the body as his sister, Matilda Hacker. After Edward told investigators that Matilda had always worn a gold watch, they visited local pawn shops to see if there were any watches that matched the description Edward had given them. One pawn shop had a golden pocket watch that was made in Canterbury, which was where Matilda and Edward Hacker were from. The investigator visited the Canterbury police, who also confirmed that the watch belonged to Matilda, whom he happened to know very well. Matilda Hacker was an eccentric woman. She and her sister were well known in Canterbury for their brightly colored dresses, and were known as the Canterbury Belles. Even in her old age, Matilda still dressed flamboyantly and dyed her hair bright red and curled it into ringlets. People often made fun of her for dressing so much younger than her age. The Hackers belonged to a wealthy family of property owners, and when Matilda's parents and sister died, Matilda gained ownership of many homes, which made her a pretty wealthy woman. Yet Matilda disliked dealing with the business and left its management to her property manager. In fact, Matilda hated dealing with the property so much that she neglected them to the point where suits were filed against her for not keeping up the homes and completing necessary improvements. She failed to show up to court cases and refused to pay fines, which sent her to jail for a short period of time. After she was released, she left for London, where she stayed in several boarding houses under different names. In August of 1877, Matilda rented a room on the second floor of 4 Euston Square, under the name Miss Hewish. The quirky Miss Hewish was known for sitting around, reading out of what she called the Book of Dreams, which she claimed helped her to predict the future. Mary Bastendorf did not recognize the name Matilda Hacker, but she did recall a Miss Hewish who was in the record of her lodgers that she showed to the police. But she hadn't gone missing from Euston Square. She paid her bill and left. But come to think of it, Mary thought, it was Hannah Dobbs who collected the rent from Miss Hewish and helped to check her out. The investigator returned to the pawn shop where they found the gold pocket watch, and the store owner identified the woman who pawned it as Hannah Dobbs. Many people had seen Hannah wearing the gold watch and chain. Many people noticed because it was so unusual for a servant to be walking around with expensive gold jewelry. Even Mary's mom, Elizabeth Pierce, confronted Hannah to tell her that it didn't look right for her to be wearing it around. When asked where she got it, Hannah said that her uncle had died and bequeathed it to her. Not only did she not have family wealthy enough to do so, but she didn't even have an uncle that died recently. And that wasn't all of the new goodies that Hannah was seen with. At one time, Mary found a cash box lying around the house that she didn't recognize, and when she asked Hannah about it, she said it was hers. Hannah replied that she lost the key and had to break into it, which was why it was broken. Police managed to track down the other boarding homes Matilda stayed in, and one of the landladies of these homes identified the cash box as belonging to Matilda. And her Book of Dreams, too, was also left behind and discovered by Hannah, along with some other belongings, like a trunk that was found hidden in the attic. So less than 2 months after finding the body in the cellar, Hannah Dobbs found herself in court, accused of murdering Matilda Hacker. The Old Bailey courthouse first heard the testimonies of those who discovered the body, then of the coroner and pathologist. Dr. Pepper said that he was also asked to examine a piece of stained carpet that came from the room Matilda stayed in. He said that though the stain was rather small on top, the bottom of it had a larger, circular-shaped stain, consistent with liquid being spilled and only cleaned from the top. Because of the tests available at the time, Dr. Pepper was only able to say that the stain was blood from a mammal, but could not determine if it was human or animal. A chemist also testified to testing parts of organs that were found with the body, pieces of the kidneys, liver, and large intestine, and said that they had no trace of poison. After hearing the testimonies of those who knew Matilda, both in Canterbury and London, who all backed up the evidence against Hannah they had so far, the court then called upon Mary Bastendorf. Mary explained that because she leaves most of the boarding home's daily tasks to the servant, she only saw Matilda on two occasions as she was on her way to church, and thus did not get to know her well. And while Hannah told police that the last time she saw the supposed Miss Ewish was before Hannah left on a trip to Hampstead Heath, because when she returned, Matilda was already gone. Mary had a completely different story of Matilda's checkout. Mary said that she remembered Severin asking Hannah to go and get the rent from Matilda. Mary thought it odd that Hannah immediately jumped up and ran upstairs to do so, because on all other occasions she was reluctant to collect rent from the tenants. Hannah supposedly brought the bill upstairs and came down with a 5-pound note. Severin gave Hannah change to bring up to Matilda along with a receipt. When she returned again, Hannah told Mary that Matilda was leaving. Mary told the court that it wasn't at all unusual for boarders to leave suddenly without warning, that it was just the way the business worked. Mary went on with her day in the busy and noisy kitchen and never noticed that she never actually saw or heard Matilda leave. But when Mary finally went up to the vacant room, she was horrified to find that not only was a lamp broken, but there was a stain on her expensive carpet. The stain, which was by the bed, was pretty noticeable because whoever tried to clean it let the colors run, leaving a lighter colored spot on the dark carpet. She chastised Hannah for not telling her sooner, saying, quote, "You are a dreadful girl to trust anyone's things to. I had a great deal better be without lodgers than have my things destroyed in this way. I wish I had seen this before she went away. I would have made her pay for the damage." End quote. Mary noticed that Hannah did not even bother to look at the stain, which irked her even more, and got even more annoyed when Hannah just sat there looking confused and saying nothing. Mary told the court that while Hannah worked for her, she never had any reason to go into the coal cellar, for Hannah always did so for her. In the course of the investigation, a woman came forward who lived right next door to the Bastendorfs at 5 Euston Square. She said that on the 14th of October, 1877, right when Matilda went missing, she heard an unnatural scream coming from the Bastendorfs' home. The sound terrified her, and she was sure something horrible happened, which was why she remembered it so well. Her testimony, along with those who saw Matilda last, put the date of her disappearance and death at Sunday, October 14th, 1877. This date also fits with how long the pathologist said the corpse had been in the cellar, as well as Mary's record book that noted Matilda checking out on Monday, the 15th. When Severin took the stand, he explained that on the 14th of October, he had a pretty airtight alibi because he had left town to go hunting. And not just that, but he was seen by two policemen, one who stopped him to check his hunting license, and another who gave him a ticket for shooting his gun too close to the road. As these pretrial examinations were winding down, the magistrate turned to Hannah Dobbs and asked if she had any questions. Hannah replied, "I have no questions to ask of Mrs. Bastendorf," emphasis on the Mrs. "When Mr. Bastendorf is present, I shall have some questions to put." As if all of England weren't already absorbed in the murder at Euston Square, Hannah's implication had all of the court reporters reeling. When court resumed, Severin's brother Peter was called to testify. After asking him how he heard of the body's discovery, he said from the newspapers, the court then began asking him questions about his relationship to Hannah, whom Peter admitted he kept company with for the past 2 years. He was asked if he and Hannah were engaged, to which he said no. You do not know then, the man asked Peter, that a child had been born? Jaws dropped. I know nothing of that, Peter responded. You do not know then that you were the parent of one? I do not. Peter was then asked if he knew anything about a broken lamp. Hannah told Peter that she accidentally broke a lamp once and cut her hand on it, which began bleeding, he said. He knew nothing about Miss Ewish and knew nothing about the coal cellar. Peter left the stand, but the scandal lingered. Hannah and Peter had been secretly sleeping together, and from Hannah's reaction, Severin knew all about it. The court then went after Severin, asking about his relationship with Hannah. Severin insisted that he had no relationship with Hannah outside of the home, and had never met with her elsewhere. He admitted to being fond of Hannah, but only because she was involved with his brother and was, after all, working for him and his wife. He liked her enough to gift her with a cabinet, only worth half a crown, he said. Everyone was very confused when Severin nonchalantly admitted to borrowing a decent sum of money from Hannah on one occasion. He explained that he ordered a crate of claret that he needed money to pay for, which he didn't have on him at the moment, and so he borrowed some from Hannah and repaid her the same week. No one ever explained how Hannah had all of this money on her. Despite these revelations, and despite everyone witnessing the trial feeling as though there were many questions yet to be answered truthfully, none of the witnesses had any more to say. And so, as the trial came to a conclusion, the jury decided that there was insufficient evidence to convict Hannah with murder, particularly when the punishment for murder was death. Sure, she was a thief and an immoral woman, but nothing they heard convinced them that Matilda Hacker died at the hands of anyone. For all they knew, Matilda could have hung herself, or died of entirely natural causes and simply had her body hidden, to avoid any stigma attaching itself to the Bastendorf boarding house. After all, there was no evidence of violence done to Matilda's body. Hannah Dobbs was declared not guilty. She returned to prison for the remainder of her previous sentence, only a few more weeks, and then was released. Hannah left the prison a celebrity. She was from the countryside and came to London because she wanted to be someone, after all, and must have figured that any publicity is good publicity. After her release, Hannah worked with George Perkis, publisher of the Illustrated Police News that had extensively covered the Jack the Ripper murders, to publish Hannah's side of the case. Together, Perkis and Hannah, working with a ghostwriter since Hannah was illiterate, published a special police news edition of the Euston Square Mystery, titled Extraordinary Statement Made by Hannah Dobbs, containing her life and early career, history of Miss Hacker while in Euston Square, harrowing details, story of the murder. Price, 1 penny. Hannah's pamphlet was a phenomenal blend of fiction and fact. And while the facts were harder to discern, the fiction was quite obvious. Hannah admitted she had a problem with stealing, that it felt as though she couldn't help herself, She was grateful for her time in prison because she deserved it, and because it set her back on a righteous path. Hannah, she said, was ready to turn her life around. But first, she would have to tell everyone the truth. Hannah declared that Severin had not been telling the truth in his testimony. She said that while working as a servant at a home prior to the Bastendorfs, she had been cleaning the windows while Severin walked by. He stopped Hannah and the servant girl with her and asked if they wanted any help, to which she said yes. She claimed she was a virgin, but after meeting Severin, she arranged to see him again. "We went to bed," she said, "and he had connection with me there." The affair continued for some time until Severin told her that his wife was looking for a new servant and encouraged her to apply, telling her when to do so and what to say. Upon being accepted into 4 Euston Square, the affair continued as Severin snuck around at night to have sex with her. And it was here that she met Peter Bastendorf, who quickly made it known that he was interested in Hannah. But then, Hannah realized she was pregnant. She told Severin, who told Hannah to give Peter a key to her room so that he could sneak in at night. She should let Peter sleep with her and then put the pregnancy on him. And so she did, sleeping with both Peter and Severin for the remainder of her time at Euston Square. She became loosely engaged to Peter because of her pregnancy, and so most people were aware that Peter and Hannah were seeing each other romantically. She even went with Peter back to her home in Bidford, where she introduced Peter as her husband and herself as Mrs. Bastendorf. Hannah had not begun to show her pregnancy when she suffered a miscarriage. Even after Hannah left the house and stopped serving Mary Bastendorf, Severin continued to sneak her into the home at night. If you're thinking, man, this is pretty racy for Victorian London, well, that's what they said too. And let me let you in on a little secret about Victorians. They pretended to be all prudish and pure, but the truth is that they freaking loved sex scandals and murder. They ate it up. They obsessed over true crime with a passion that rivals even ours with all of our documentaries and podcasts, which is how this case blew up in the press so spectacularly. Just when readers thought they had heard the most scandalous news of their life, another revelation shocked them further, and another, and another. And here is where the story turns from salacious to morbid. Hannah suggested that Severin was guilty of not just murdering Matilda, whom he supposedly killed to get her money and expensive jewelry, but several others. She said she last saw Matilda as she went to post a letter, different from her earlier statement, and when she didn't return, Severin told her that Matilda was dead and buried on the property. Not only that, but Hannah suspected Severin of murdering another boarder, Mr. Findlay. One day, Hannah became aware of a little boy in their yard, no more than 10 years old, and looking as though he were homeless because his clothes were all in tatters. When they, and I say they because that's what Hannah said most of the time because she was very vague about exactly who did what in her pamphlet, but anyway, they chased the little boy until he hid under the workshop. Trying to get him out, one of the men beat him with a poker. Hannah said she was about to run for a doctor when the men stopped her. They forced her to wash the now dead body of the little boy, after which he was wrapped in cloth and hidden under a bed in the workshop. Hannah cried, "Would to God they had laid me there too!" And yet, she stayed at Euston Square. Not long after the boy's murder, Hannah claimed that the men found a stray dog and began feeding the murdered boy's meat to it. Before long, the men began beating the dog, and Severin's other brother Joseph shot the animal and then skinned it alive, despite all of Hannah's crying and begging them not to. Hannah said the act, quote, filled me with a tenfold longing to leave the dreadful place, end quote. And yet again, she stayed. Three people and one dog were murdered, and Hannah still chose to stay, and stay silent. Hannah was clearly lying about these three other murders, but with her testimony that Severin had lied while under oath, by denying a relationship with Hannah and lying about when they met, Severin was indicted for perjury. During the trial, the other servant that was present when Hannah supposedly met Severin while washing windows backed up Hannah's version of the story. And yet, there were other conflicting accounts that the landlady of that house never asked the servants to clean the windows because she was in the habit of paying a man to come and do the window washing. And another woman stepped forward, a Mrs. Carpenter of the Beehive in Reigate, north of London. She said she saw both Hannah and Severin together at her home during the summer of 1877, directly contradicting Severin's claim to have never seen Hannah outside of Euston Square. The court ultimately declared Severin guilty of willful perjury and sentenced him to a year in prison doing hard labor. There might have been enough evidence for the court to declare him guilty of lying about his affair with Hannah, but nothing they discovered during the second trial proved that Severin killed anyone, save for the word of a woman who was a known liar and fame seeker. McKay says that today we would understand Hannah Dobbs as a sociopath, utterly lacking any empathy or remorse. Her compulsive lying and stealing, along with her theatrical behavior in court, were, to McKay, proof of her sociopathy, and one of the reasons why he believes Hannah Dobbs was guilty of the murder after all. The murder at Euston Square has never been solved. At the conclusion of his book about the mystery, McKay pens his theory of what happened to Matilda Hacker. First of all, it made no sense to him that Severin would have been the murderer. Even if we were to believe that Matilda was not murdered on the day everyone supposes, ignoring the times when other witnesses claimed to have seen Matilda alive and taking away Severin's alibi, it would still be nonsensical for him to murder Matilda for money and then just give all of that money and jewelry away to Hannah. And it doubly doesn't make sense for him to murder someone and then just leave the body inside his own house for anyone to find, along with Matilda's possessions. And we have to believe that he was smart enough, if he did kill her, to pawn those items elsewhere rather than just next to his home. If it was money that Severin needed, why would he risk scandalizing his home where his family and businesses are? And if it wasn't for money, what other motive could he possibly have for killing the quirky, but otherwise harmless, old Miss Hacker? McKay's theory is this. On Sunday, October 14, 1877, the house on 4 Euston Square was quiet. Severin was away hunting, and Mary was out staying with her mother. The workshop was closed because it was Sunday, and Hannah was taking care of the children all the way up on the third floor where their bedrooms were. Perhaps some of the kids were sleeping. Perhaps others were occupied playing games. One boarder left on a business trip, and the only other one staying there, Matilda, had just returned to her room. And perhaps Matilda was irritated. Perhaps she had heard all of the sneaking around at night. Perhaps she was aware that the home was not as upstanding as it pretended to be. And perhaps she was already suspicious of Hannah, whom she believed was far too bold for a servant. Maybe Matilda already thought Hannah was up to something when she entered her room and found her things moved around. Maybe something was missing. Maybe it was just anger at her privacy being violated. But Matilda grew angry and waited until she heard Hannah pass by. When she heard footsteps, Matilda flung the door open to find Hannah, in the process of sneaking Peter upstairs. An argument began. Peter went upstairs to keep an eye on the children while Hannah stayed to convince Matilda that she hadn't done anything. Hannah's lies made Matilda angrier. She knew Hannah was the only one home while she was out, and so she threatened Hannah, telling her that she would tell Mary Bassendorf about her sneaking and rifling through people's things, about her sneaking a man into the house. Hannah tried to stop Matilda, block her from leaving. Matilda tried to break free, and Hannah tried to keep her there, and all of a sudden they were engaged in a struggle, and a lamp was knocked onto the floor and broken in the process. Hannah shoved Matilda, who fell and hit her head on something. Matilda screamed so loud the neighbor heard. To shut her up, Hannah sat on her chest and pressed her hands over Matilda's mouth and nose, suffocating her as her head wound leaked blood onto the carpet. Hannah thought Matilda was dead. She wrapped her body in oilcloth and dragged her quickly down into the cellar, where she realized that Matilda was still faintly breathing. Hannah grabbed a clothesline, wrapped it around Matilda's head, and pulled. She buried the woman under mounds of coal, then went back upstairs to clean up the lamp and carpet as best she could before returning to Peter and the children. The next day, she brought a bill up to Matilda's room and grabbed some money to pay it. She returned to the empty room with change, which she kept, and then went back downstairs to tell Mary Bassendorf that Miss Ewish was leaving. At some point, Hannah packed the less valuable of Matilda's things into her trunk and then locked it up in the attic. Does Peter ever find out, or by extension Severin? McKay is not sure. And this is pretty close to how I imagine the murder happened too, and I generally follow Occam's philosophy that the simplest explanation is often the correct one. Hannah was the one to check out the dead Matilda out of her room. Hannah was the one found with Matilda's belongings, and Hannah was the one who pawned Matilda's jewelry. Hannah was caught lying about plenty of things, including about getting a pocket watch from an imaginary dead uncle, when the watch really belonged to a dead woman. And Hannah was already a proven kleptomaniac. While she stood trial for the murder, she showed almost no emotion, not even fear for her situation. She remained aloof and unsentimental, just as a sociopath would, just as someone who cares only for their own self-interest would. In fact, the trial seemed like a game to her. I'm not sure if she was telling the truth about her affair with Severin, but I am convinced that she did kill Matilda Hacker. So much of Matilda's body was gone by the time it was discovered, so we will never know if she was stabbed or shot or suffocated. To me, it doesn't seem likely that someone would wrap a rope around Matilda's neck twice in order to strangle her. It seems much more likely that Matilda was killed in her room, where the broken lamp and bloodstains were. And then the rope was used to drag her body down the stairs and into the cellar, particularly if the murderer did not have help and was a woman with a small frame. And the fact that the corpse sat in the cellar for years tells me that the murderer was unable to move the body to a better location. Had the Bassendorfs known about the body in the cellar, and or were the ones who killed her, they certainly would never have left the corpse there for it to ruin their businesses and their lives. Because the Bassendorfs never fully recovered from the scandal. As you can imagine, no one wanted to stay in such a place. Boarding houses had a bad rep to begin with, and the Bassendorfs was now home to a murder, a sex scandal, and, by some accounts, hauntings. In fact, people were so upset by the murder that they successfully petitioned to change the name Euston Square to Onslet Gardens. For Euston Square was demolished. The injustice of it all drove Severin mad. He filed a libel suit against Purkis, the publisher of Hannah's pamphlet, which Severin won and was awarded a settlement. Yet after his torturous imprisonment, Severin began showing signs of mental illness, which further strained his marriage with Mary to the point where she had him committed to a mental hospital. He was released for some time, but then suffered another break and returned to the hospital, where he spent the remainder of his life. Matilda's murderer was never brought to justice. Hannah was likely forced to move and change her name if she was to have any chance of gaining employment again. Hannah Dobbs simply disappeared. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or rating. It really does help us out a lot in terms of helping others to find our podcast. And speaking of, because Old Blood is such a small operation, we have had to transition to bi-weekly episodes for the foreseeable future. It is my hope that Old Blood can get more recognition because that would mean more help to get these episodes out faster and hopefully return to putting out weekly episodes. For now, though, I will see you in 2 Mondays. Again, much of this episode was based on Sinclair MacKay's wonderful book, The Lady in the Cellar, which I highly recommend. For a complete list of our sources, please see our show notes or visit oldbloodpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook by searching for Old Blood Podcast. Music credits to Shane Ivers at silvermansound.com.